I think that we should probably count on having our heart broken. I think we should probably count on losing. I remember, I'll never forget, when in graduate school, I had a professor who I deeply looked up to. He was a marriage and family therapist, and he said something. And what he said was that every relationship ends. Nobody makes it out alive. You know, I think we have to take away the goal of perpetuity. We have to take away the goal of permanence. It's not about safety. It's about learning how to love the storm.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Deeper Podcast, a podcast for all of you who want more. More out of yourself, your relationships, your intimacy, and life. My name is Sophie Josefina, and I'm here to bring you deeper. I'm a sex, life, and relating coach, and I'm fascinated by all things masculine and feminine and bringing the two back together, helping people connect on a deep and real level so we can show up for each other, partner with each other in our healing, and call each other back into our power. A very important part of that for me is honoring both sides, the masculine and the feminine, creating more understanding, more compassion, and respect for each unique experience. And so in this series, I'm speaking specifically to men to honor them, to hear their perspective and how they go through relating the feminine life. Because so often we have demonized and devalued men in their experiences, needs, and struggles. And I want to change that. So I hereby welcome you to my Deeper Into Him podcast series. And before we get started for all these conversations, I want to give a bit of a disclaimer because I realize that this conversation about men and women, masculine and feminine, can sound both heteronormative and gendered. Bear with me. Masculine-feminine dynamics play it out in every relationship. So when we speak about men towards women, I hope you can hear it as being the partner who's more in their masculine and the partner who's more in their feminine. And this very often has little to do with gender. In addition to that, I do want to acknowledge that men and women have completely different societal expectations in the world. And because of that, different lenses. For instance, we tell men they should man up and women they should smile more. In that sense, some of this might be gendered, but I hope for people outside of that binary perspective that they might still feel some truth in any of these stories. Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Deeper Podcast with Sophie Josefina. And I am so, so excited for this episode today because today I am joined by Rainier Wild, pronouncing it correctly. And Rainier, if you don't know him yet, definitely check him out on Instagram because his writing is so incredibly powerful. I don't know that many people that can write with such, I think, depth and maybe an integration. I think the word is like integration. You write from a very integrated place, very mature. And Rainier is a teacher, a guide, and a writer who works with both men and women, who has a very interesting story that I will ask him about in a second. And he helps them confront their shadow, find intimate union with the masculine and feminine, and experience spiritual awakening. So I'm so happy he's here today on this podcast. Rainier, hi.
Hi. Oh, it is so good to be here. And we were finding out just moments ago the strange and beautiful interwoven paths of which we know each other upon and have had shared experiences. So I'm just so excited to be here.
I'm so happy to hear that. Yeah, I love all these little synchronicities of life.
It's so true.
So for people who don't know you, who is Rainier? What's your story? What are you bringing to this world right now? What's alive in you?
Yeah, I was just talking about this with someone. I think it's really interesting how we define ourselves, how we choose to define ourselves. Anything you define as yourself, you inevitably have to defend. Yeah. And this is something I don't think we spend a lot of time considering, right? We don't spend a lot of time considering that our identities are like armors by which we present ourselves to the world, that become the place where we take the shocks, take the hits. They protect us. They also prevent us from living life so fully. Everything that I identify as or define myself as, while a powerful defense and a secure blanket of certainty that I camp upon, inevitably becomes that thing, but that I must defend, that I must hold and be attached to. And I always think back, I was 17 years old and I was in a band, because one of my previous lives is I was a musician and a singer songwriter who was touring and doing all these wonderful things, playing music and writing songs. I was a sad-eyed singer of sad-eyed songs for sad-eyed lovers. And so that was a wonderful part of my past. And I got into an argument with one of the musicians in the band, and I was staking my claim on being an intellectual. And I said, I am an intellectual. And I look back and I think, oh my God, only a 17-year-old would say such things. And I said, I'm an intellectual. And he said, I don't think you are. And for 2 hours, we went back and forth about this claim. It got very, very heated. And finally, he said something. He said, you know, I really don't think you are an intellectual, because an intellectual wouldn't have to defend it quite so much as you're having to defend it right now. Oof. And I think that therein lies an important understanding, that the understandings we have of ourselves, the roles by which we define, we're rarely so secure in. Otherwise, we wouldn't trumpet them so loudly. Oh, I want to be this. So I want everyone else to see me as this. And if everyone else sees me as this, then maybe that will make it true. Maybe this will make it true. So I find it far more interesting to define oneself by the things we don't speak of, the things that are sacred, the vows that we don't say are all the true vows, as David White says in a beautiful poem, right? Those are the sacred things. So you ask me who I am. Well, I think the world could go to my Instagram and see that I'm a writer. And why am I a writer? Well, I write. I wake up every morning and I grab this little device, right? My typewriter, my modern typewriter. And instead of my father's typewriter that he used pecking out the keys with two fingers, I use two thumbs. And I type on my two-thumbed typewriter and I create these short little essays that I post on Instagram or other places. I write. I write every day. I write with a great deal of consistency and vulnerability. So I'm a writer. I teach. And why am I a teacher? Well, I'm a teacher because I teach, exactly as I say. It's an action. The moment I stop teaching, I will stop being a teacher, right? I'm not grounding that in any aspiration. It's simply something that happens. I remember being about a very young man and having just read a book that I thought was particularly delightful. I got in the car with a mentor and I proceeded to unload the whole of the book I had just read upon him. And he said, you can't help it, can you? And I said, what? He said, you can't help but teach. And I think that's true, right? I think that I'm one of those people where if there's something bursting forth inside of me, I'm going to find a way to say it. I'm going to find a way to unroll that for others. I think that besides being a writer, besides being a teacher, those are the very public faces of who I am. Yeah. The reality is I'm a father also. Mm-hmm. I'm a father of four beautiful children. Wow. Who see my imperfections, who see my inconsistencies, who see the vulnerability by which I approach moment to moment those sacred places where everything falls apart, where you're yelling at the sky, and they still love me. Just this morning, I sent my 14-year-old a text. I said very simply these words. I said to him, I just want to let you know how much I love you, how proud I am of you, and proud that I'm your dad. I don't always get it right. I'm not exactly always the thing I wish to be in every moment I wish it, but that doesn't change how I feel about you. I'm so sorry for any harsh words or tense moments we had over the weekend. The reality is I take full responsibility for those, and I love you. His response, God, Dad, I sure love you too. those are the moments that I live for. Those are those sacred moments of being a father that no one sees. Yeah. I'm a husband of 10 years, a husband twice over, a prior marriage that ended for so many reasons, and then a current marriage that has taken so many twists and turns and incredible shifts in the plot line to where the characters that presented themselves in the first part of the book are hardly recognizable to the characters towards this middle section. And you look at these two characters who are sharing this life and you realize that there is a single thread, of course, that ties them to those former selves. And yet they are no longer themselves. They've been transformed. And every moment I get to turn over in the morning and smelling my own breath and smelling her breath, heavy from sleep, and touch her hair. And I say, oh my God, is this the same woman I married? And no, of course it's not. And how grateful I am to continue to be loved by this soul who is so many things to me, but is at least the person I choose. And I think those two roles, which are also actions in themselves, continue to define my heart. I think lastly, probably what I would say is that I am someone who is dedicated to my own transformation and dedicated within that to the transformation of others. This is probably the consuming work of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, transformation, when it happens, it may take years to create, to engineer so many things, a lifetime really, go into transformation. But when it happens, oh my God, when it happens, it always happens in the twinkling of an eye, like a thief in the night. It comes and it turns the world upside down. It overturns the tables and leaves us breathless. Mm. And I'm sort of an addict to that moment. I'm a junkie for it. I live for it in myself and in others. And I live to tell those stories, the stories of my own transformations. And what I find is that the more I share those stories nakedly, with sincerity and with the depth of saying, this is who I am, I can do no other. When I do that, it somehow creates a space for others to step into and to share their own stories and then experience their own transformations. And I think that is probably one of the longest, most long-winded way of saying who and what I am in this moment. But there you are.
Yeah, Rainier. You are just like poetry embodied. This is so beautiful. I can just listen to you for hours. Wow. You definitely like moved me when you spoke something about the mundane, almost that there's so much beauty in the mundane, in just the love that you have with your children, that they just get to see the real you and like the morning breath with your beloved. Like there's such beauty in the mundane. There's such beauty in the mundane. And we think it's all these like fancy big moments. And that's also where I think transformation happens.
Yeah.
I always think there's going to be, like, I've been very sick my whole life. I always think like, there's going to be this big moment when all of a sudden I'm healthy, and it doesn't happen. It's in these very small, simple moments. And I'm like, oh yeah, actually that's much better than a year ago. And it's already there. It's just this very like simple, there's something simple to it all. And so I love how you speak about this, like this, the mundaneness of life and how there's so much beauty in that very simple moment, that very real life moment. Yeah.
You know, this is something that I wrote about just this morning, actually. I was thinking about my deep love for paradise. The older I get, the less I enjoy about my current location. I live in a rainy corner of the world. Oh my God. The rain never stops. The fog and the gray and the drizzle and the cold. Oh my God. It takes its toll on me, I tell you. And I start to fantasize about somewhere else, right? Some other abundant, less hard, less cold place, less way of making it out alive. And, you know, just recently, actually, I was sitting in a friend's bar and winter's cold grip was upon me. And all I could think about was going to Mexico or Hawaii or anywhere but where I was. And I started to feel real cagey, and I started to like make up real stupid things in my head. Like, I was made for sunny days, you know, like that tumbled out of me and then quickly followed with, what the hell does that even mean? You know, the truth is I wouldn't want a life only made up of those, because the cold is a lover too. Oof. Right. And huddling around those campfires or letting the burnt taste of that whiskey hit the back of my throat, burning down into me, even dreaming of summer warmth and not experiencing it. Even that dream is a kind of decadence that tastes delicious. And I think that we limit our view of what paradise is. But the reality that I continue to stumble on more and more is, when I think of life, I want all of it or I want none of it. Mm. You know, and some people want something, they want to start something, but they won't finish it. And I say, why bother? You know, why take one season without the other? Why open the door if you won't walk in? Why even take the drink? You know, all I need is really everything. And so paradise really becomes this wholehearted, total self that loves everything in equal measure. Yeah. And I think the ones who have really tasted deeply, who have drank deeply from the cup of sorrows, right, who have risked, who have given, who have failed, who have tried and tried again. These are the ones I really want to spend time with, because they know it's not just those sunny days, and that paradise, after all, isn't someplace out there, but rather is a different kind of dimensional approach to the world, that it can be the same old shape, but now it's a new dimension. It's gone from the square to the cube, right? It's suddenly something so much more, so that I'm experiencing the same old, same old, same old, and yet everything is different in that moment. That is, I think, as you're saying, that really is transformation. Then suddenly paradise is everywhere, right? Because it's actually in me.
So I felt this very strongly when I a few years ago, I lost my mother and I lost my relationship, and it was my very dark night of the soul. Lost my health, lost friends, lost many things in like the span of 2 weeks. And I learned the sweetness of grief, because it was in the depths of grief that I felt love and bliss, and it made no sense. Right. Like, really, when I didn't know how to get up anymore because the grief had overtaken me, there was some kind of bliss and love and just gratitude for having known this kind of a connection as a human being. And so I've also, like, when I've been in extreme amounts of pain that has happened, there's some especially in the big, when these things become very big, we realize that they're actually not that different from the bliss and from the fun states and from the beautiful states that we're all looking for. And you're reminding me, like, I was reading a little bit through your Instagram again, kind of seeing again what you'd been writing about lately. You wrote this beautiful post about the art of worshiping a woman.
Oh, yes.
And what that really means, because this is, I think, very similar to what you're just talking about. Do you want to speak into that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. You know, within that little essay that I was writing, I started by cautioning to think twice about worshiping. And think twice about worshiping this person you're with. And in part, at least, this was born in an experience I had with a lover who, as a young male in that moment, I stood in front of her and I said very nakedly, I worship you. I adore you. I venerate you. I mean, I was really laying it on incredibly thick. And she paused me and said, you know, almost with a similar smile as you just had on your face, she said, oh, don't let me off the hook so easily.
Yeah.
You know, don't diminish me so easily. And I really didn't understand what that meant in that moment. I didn't quite know what she meant. But I think that as I've gotten older, what I've understood is that whenever we objectify something, whenever it becomes the arbiter of all that is good and holy and beautiful, we're not really seeing them anymore. It's not them. They're now a cardboard cutout of perfection, right? We've pedestalized them, right? We've made them something they're not. They're no longer real. And here's what I know. You can only worship real things. Like, you can only worship something when you're seeing it. And if you're worshiping something blindly and with immense veneration as I was then, I wasn't seeing her anymore. And she knew it. And she called me on it. And so, you know, I like to laugh. The fuller explanation of that post might be found in an experience that happened with my partner not too long ago. We were in the grocery store, and we had separated, not in the grand sweeping arc of things. We were still together, but she was doing her shopping on her aisle, and I was doing shopping on my aisle, and I was rummaging through the vitamins section. You know, it's so funny. The older I get, the more I you know, need a variety of vitamins. And so I was rifling through all the supplements and seeing all the things. And she probably got all the shopping done in the time it took me to check what new supplement there was. And I had my head buried in the vitamin D section going through the different options. And I look over out of the corner of my eye, and down the aisle coming towards me is an absolute goddess. I mean, just the female figure of perfection personified in curves and hair and legs, and who, what wondrous creature. It's my wife. And she's coming towards me, and I'm literally on my knees because I'm trying to, you know, get the specific vitamins on the lowest shelf. And I look over there on my knees as this absolute goddess comes towards me. And I realize I am absolutely making obeisance towards her. I am worshiping her, so to speak, in that moment. But you know, that comes after years of knowing who a person is. I know her. Oh, the ins and outs. I know the smells and the sounds. I know the twists of the tongue and the despair. I know her story almost better than she does at this point. There isn't a surprise. Oh, but there is such a surprise, you know. And so in those moments of that, I go, oh, this is real worship. The thing that we call worship, the thing that we often label, that's an objectification. That's nonsense. It's loving the thing as it is. That's love. And if I could just continue that for a moment, I think that most of what we call love is really a pacification of our own need. Yeah. Oof. Like, I need you not to feel so I cannot feel alone. I need you so that I can feel like I have some belonging. I need you so that I can finish this story I have about women and mothers and my own connection to the mother or whatever that is. And that's me speaking as a man, but I think women could also own that same experience. I need you to fill some kind of void I have. And so I say, I love you, but it's not an I love you, is it? Yeah. I need you to fill something. It's very transactional. Mm-hmm. And so that what I would prefer to do is to stand in front of someone who I know deeply, completely, and say, I love you and mean it. Not because I'm looking for an outcome, not because I need them to say, I love you back, but because here I stand, I can do nothing else. That's love. That's worship. Everything else is a delicate illusion that falls apart when the wind blows too hard. Mm-hmm.
I've been I've been exploring what safety actually is in relationships, right? We talk so much about avoidant and anxious and wounded polarity. So I'm like, okay, so I know what the toxicity or the woundedness is, and I know that very intimately, like everybody does. But what does actually security taste like? What does safety taste like? And I can feel on my body and my system that I'm currently in a very safe and secure relationship, and I'm literally trying to define it of what makes it. So, and one of the big things for me has been that I can feel that truly all of me is welcome there. And not just like the, emotionally healthy part of me, or the part of me that does all the spiritual bullshit, right? Right. It's not just that part of me. It's also when I'm grumpy or PMSing or exhausted, or I've worked too hard for 3 days, or I couldn't get out of bed for 3 days, or I'm overly excited about something and losing track of time. Like, all those versions of me are welcome here. Because right. He actually sees me when I'm sometimes a bit more avoidant in this relationship. When I am more avoidant,
yeah,
he sees me. He's actually partnering with me, not with some idealized version of me that, you know, never gets triggered. Because it's not true. I don't know. Everybody that I've gotten to know on Instagram that I've looked up to, that I thought they have their shit together. When you get to know them, their relationships are messy as fuck. Like, there is nobody that I've met that I think you're emotionally completely solid, because I don't think that actually can happen. I still have my triggers. I still have my insecurities. So does he. And it's much more about how we are partnering together with true, like, with love. Like,
yeah,
that's just my blueprint, and he has his blueprint, and we're all like human. We're all human, and we're all messy, and that's mm-hmm. okay. And so there's really this safety thing of like, can I truly accept you for who you are? And I don't think I don't, that, like, I tell him that every day. I'm like, I finally feel what love is. Because especially as a woman, I've always felt like there's too much of me, or I'm needy, or I'm high maintenance, or I'm too emotional, or I'm too on off, too excitable, whatever. I'm too this. And to actually feel that there, that at least this current man is okay. He's okay. There's no too much. That doesn't mean I can't get toxic. Of course I can. There are boundaries for that, but there's no expression of me that's too much. And so why am I saying this story? Yeah, I would love your reflection of like what makes a relationship or a connection actually safe or secure, or whatever the word is, or actually meeting each other rather than this like idealized, like, you need to hold your own traumas, like that. It's work, right? You're triggering it anyways. Yeah, what's coming up for you?
Well, the first thing I want to say is I think you and I see really eye to eye on what should pass between relating. That authentic relationship actually begins with that first word, authentic.
Yes.
And it is bringing my whole self.
Yeah.
As you bring your whole self, I am I and you are you. And if by chance we meet, wonderful. And if not, wonderful. Yeah. And so I bring my whole self. That's so important. The other thing I just want to interject here is, you know, relationships aren't safe. No. Love isn't safe. It's a profound risk. And in that risk, in that profound and terrible, absolutely vulnerable place, we reach out of our loneliest loneliness to another, and we show ourselves and invite them in. And it's the very opposite of safe. It's totally foolhardy. I've got to be honest. The safest, most reasonable thing in the world is actually to remain a hermit somewhere. It's just that probably is just the best course of action if safety is your God. I think that we should probably count on having our heart broken. I think we should probably count on being betrayed. I think we should probably count on losing. I remember, I'll never forget when in graduate school, I had a professor who I deeply looked up to. He was a marriage and family therapist who had been so for over 50 years. He had gotten into the field when it was just in its infancy and had seen just about everything. And he said something. And what he said was that every relationship ends. Nobody makes it out alive. They either end in death or divorce, but they all end. You know, I think we have to take away the goal of perpetuity. We have to take away the goal of permanence. It's not about safety. It's about learning how to live with risk. It's about learning how to live with loss. It's about learning how to live with regret. It's about learning to take responsibility for the things I bring. It's about learning how to love the storm. You know, I think that sometimes we think that we can armor our lives in such a way to avoid the storms. I spent most of my life weathering the storms by one beautiful skill. And I think it is a skill. The skill was, this too shall pass.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk to people who have profound crises in their life, this is one of those great distress tolerance techniques that they can use, you know. And even recently, I told my 10-year-old, I said, if you're going to get through something at school, one of the best ways to do it is think, in 5 years, will this really matter? You know, like, don't sweat the small stuff. And it's a really great skill. But I've got to tell you, that really great skill ran out of steam eventually for me. I had kept kicking the can down the field. It was my only skill I knew. This will pass. This will pass. This will pass. The storm will be over. I'll get to the good stuff eventually. Mm-hmm. And so I was weathering the storm. I was getting through life to get to the good stuff.
Yeah.
I eventually had to come to the difficult conclusion that there may never be the good stuff. That this, in fact, may be as good as it gets. And if I didn't learn to fall in love with the thing right in front of me, if I didn't learn to fall in love with the storm, to fall in love with the tragedy, to fall in love with the drama and the trauma of it all, that I was going to have died and on my tombstone would say, practiced life. I practiced. Today, when I go to die, what I want to have on my tombstone is used up, spent, right? I don't want to leave a single drop out. And that means the highs. That means the lows too. That means a lot of loneliness. And I say that not as someone who hasn't experienced it. I'll tell you, when I realized that, I was sitting in the driver's seat of my car and I was looking over at my partner, and I had been through probably the hardest thing I had ever gone through in my life, the loss of career, the loss of reputation, the loss of friends, the loss of family. I mean, it was just one of the most devastating experiences. And the worst part was, it just wasn't stopping. Like, it just kept going and going. And I looked at her and I was sobbing. And I've really only sobbed this way twice in my life. And before I come back to this moment, I'll tell the first moment. When I had gone through my first divorce, and it was my 30th birthday, and my ex-wife planned it for me. And it was just an extreme generosity on her part, an extreme kindness, surrounded by family, surrounded by friends, but going through this intense tragedy of soul, and my heart couldn't hold it. Mm-hmm. And so I leave the party early. My party, this party celebrating me. I can't stay there. The pain is too great. And I come home, and my home in that moment was the lower part of a house, a basement of someone else's home that I was staying in, an unfinished, cold, dungeon-like basement that when I went to the door to open it, I was locked out of. So then I had to go to a window by my room, and I had to kick open the window. And then I crawled through this tiny portal, and I'm not a small man, and I squeeze my shoulders through this portal, and it's ceiling height, and I fall a full 7 feet, 6 to 7 feet, onto a bookcase below, and I'm now sitting surrounded by books that have done me no good, learning that has not amounted to knowing, and I just begin to allow a soft moan to come out of my chest, a pain that is now in my body, a storm that has gone from outside of me to inside of me. And now I begin to moan like an animal that's wounded, caught in a bear trap. Mm-hmm. And that moan grows louder and louder until it fills the room. And it's an angry howl gripping my heart and boiling through the whole of the house. And then I begin to sob, uncontrollable sobs. And it was as though I was standing in an ocean surrounded by intense, unclarified feeling in every direction. That was the first time. And the second time that it came upon me, it was that exact same thing. And I could not stop. And this time I was being witnessed by this person who I deeply loved, And I'm sobbing now, being witnessed, and I can't get out of this ocean. And that's when I realized I have to fall in love with that place too. If I don't fall in love with this unsafety, if I don't fall in love with this pain, then it very well may be that I don't make it out ever with anything like joy. And so standing in that place, I turned my heart to falling in love with even the storm. And so when I hear you say, you know, how can I have safety? What does safety feel like? I know that's so important. I do. I don't want anyone to feel unsafe. But I think that even more important than feeling safe or being safe is actually knowing how to get through those moments when you're not safe. Being able to become the presence of safety in your own deepest sense of self. Yeah. And falling in love with the storm and surrendering to that ocean in your own heart.
Yeah. I'm right here. Yeah. I know we haven't really touched upon this yet, but obviously, I work a lot in masculine feminine polarity, and so do you. And I think what you're beautifully describing is a skill that especially a lot of men, I think, are really only recently becoming aware of the ability to sit with discomfort, the ability to sit with the awkward, the ability to sit with criticism, the ability to sit with when she doesn't get enough from you or whatever it is, and to actually receive that and to not, like, I was actually talking to Trey Rubem about this. Like, to me, the scariest thing in the world is a man who feels small, because that's when he does some some men can do some very strange things when they feel small, and just this ability to be with that. And I realize that is black belt masculinity, I think, in for a lot of men, but just this ability to, exactly what you're saying, to sit in the storm and to be able to sit with yourself also when you're not feeling the most powerful or the most confident or like yourself that much.
Yeah. I love how you said that the man who is small, and, you know, I think so much in terms of development and developmental, the developmental nature of the masculine and the feminine. But one of the things I think about within the masculine itself that so often occurs is that those early stages of masculine development, those stages of learning how to function in courage and discipline and focus and assertiveness and even aggression when it helps to conquer that which is blocking your goals, when I think about those early stages, so many men haven't fully learned those lessons. Those were never lessons they learned. I mean, practically every man I know who was born after 1980 really learned the very opposite of that skill set. Yes. I point to my own life to think about that. You know, my mother raised me in such a way to become the kind of man who she never had access to. Oh, yeah. She taught me how to be incredibly safe. She taught me how to be the shoulder to cry on. She taught me how to be tender and gentle. She taught me how to be, you know, a second and third stage masculine development, but didn't adequately actually teach me those places of that were required to get to those further stages. Right. And so because I didn't learn those core elements, I really didn't have a solid sense of self. Right. It was all sort of a lot of outward projection. Right. So that when the tough times came, when the discomfort came, I would crumble. And then, of course, the only resource I really knew was falling upon the feminine. Right. Yeah. Leaning upon her strength that she's had to cultivate over generations of being oppressed and being pushed down. And so I would rely over easily. And I see a lot of men do that. In fact, I think a lot of what we consider to be toxic masculinity is really simply immature or uncooked or undeveloped masculine energy. Right. And it's really those things that simply lack those first stages of masculine maturity and growth. And so we need to reconnect to those places. those places really look like learning how to be a solid self, learning how to own your desires, learning how to assert your intention and to clarify that which you will in life. Mm-hmm. It's the will to power, right? Power is truly being able to make an impact on your world. I want everyone to have more power. I want you to have power. I want me to have power. Force, on the other hand, is robbing someone of their power. Yeah. It's suppressing someone's power. We need much less force in this world. We need a lot more power. And so I think that that's really how we adequately begin to teach men to mature. Now, often in traditional cultures, that would come in the form of an initiation that would transition them from adolescence to adulthood, and often much earlier than ours do. But interestingly, you know, middle age for men today presents for so many as a kind of second opportunity to reinitiate. There's a kind of ability to come full circle. Now, what I would say is this initiation, which sometimes I call the shadow initiation, because that's the way it takes the form. You're suddenly in the basement of your own shadows. This initiation is far more painful than it would have been had you simply done it at 13, right? The stakes are so much higher, right? Because now you have a family, you have a business, you have a reputation, you have a career. And so that when you confront your own mortality, when you detach from your own comfort, from your own egoic projections, oh my God, a lot of things begin to crumble. And that makes a lot of sense. That's why we see a lot of what we call the midlife crisis, right, in men. Well, what's really happening? Well, actually, they're being given a second opportunity to learn those skills, to begin to develop those resources that they didn't have in the first time. And so I think that that really is a gift. And it's one that I love when men begin to take that opportunity. Yeah, it's so important in the world. So they don't act and operate in the way that you describe their very small or fragile sense of self.
Yeah. Was that earlier what you spoke about? Is that the mother hunger that you've referred to before? That's how I got to know you. I listened to a podcast around the mother hunger and I was like, damn. So is this what you spoke earlier about? Is that mother hunger?
Yeah, that mother hunger. And so, you know, if the only resource I've ever developed as a mm-hmm. child is learning how to rely upon the soft feminine to meet my needs, if that is the best that I can do, I will simply continue to do that whenever the world becomes hard. And of course, tribal cultures, band societies, they knew this, right? They knew this about their young males. And so they would plunge them into these rather relentless, incredibly brutal conditions and force a separation from the feminine. Mm, exclusively in every initiation I found that exists in band society, there is a separation from the feminine. And I don't only mean females, I mean the soft comforts of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And why this is because the masculine line of development must begin with an assertion. And that assertion is the world is hard. And so am I. Mm. Life is difficult and I am adequate to it. And if he doesn't come to that point, he will simply run away from adversity when it occurs and run into the soft arms of the mother, whoever she may be. Yeah.
Yeah. I know you've written about this before, but so you're kind of, I think, hinting at it here. How do, in your perspective, men and women relate differently to their shadows? Mm. What's the difference there and how they go about it?
Yeah. I think that the relationship, both societally and personally, to this gender difference is very interesting. Mm-hmm. How I often see it play out is that mm-hmm. men in particular, and I mean men as opposed to the masculine, but mm-hmm. men tend to suppress their shadow mm-hmm. a lot more. And by suppress, I mean they attempt to cut it away mm-hmm. or deny it. So I like to think of like the 14-year-old male who is, you know, looking through, you know, internet porn for the first time, or and then his mother catches him, you know, and she says, are you looking at porn? And his first answer is no, absolutely not. So he's denying it. And then she brings the evidence. She's like, well, no, you forgot to delete your tracks, kid. And she, you know, holds up the page to him, shows him, and he goes, oh my God, I did it. And then she says, well, I'm marching you to the psychologist and we're going to work on this addiction. And then he now begins a program of thinking of himself as a pathological sex addict who needs help, and let's cut it away so that you can be whole and happy again. And so that's the other side of suppression, right? So suppression is not only denying or keeping things in the shadows, it's then actively trying to, quote, better myself so that I don't operate in those ways as well, which a lot of improvement culture, therapeutic culture, religious culture is really just a running that suppression act over and over and over. Yes. And let's become good little boys and girls again. Yeah. Females, on the other hand, tend to take suppression so elegantly to the next level. And of course, this is typical because I think females in general are very capable and brilliant people. When they take things on, they take it on very fully. And so the next stage of suppression is really repression, right? Yeah. And so repression is like, I've buried it so intensely that I don't even know I have it anymore. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
And so there's a kind of mind blindness to it. So if I'm talking with a couple, the male might be very, very identified with trying to suppress his sexual desires. Mm-hmm. Right. He's like, oh, I've got these really bad thoughts. I walk into a room and I want to have sex with every woman, but I'd never tell my wife this. And gosh, I joke about it with my buddies and I really shouldn't. And, you know, sometimes I look at porn and that's bad, right? Suppression. And I feel bad. Mm-hmm. The female in the relationship, on the other hand, is what sexuality? We had sex twice and that was to have our two babies. And I don't have sex. Yeah. And I really get very angry when I hear about these really slutty women out there who have lots of sex. And it really bothers me when they do this. And how dare they show their bodies out there like that? That's just horrible and pornographic and on and on. And so it's this real like denial. I don't even have a connection with my own sexuality. Yeah. And so I think that's how I see it split out so often. Mm-hmm. The other side of it is I observe feminine culture. And now I'm talking then about the energetic here. Mm-hmm. Actually has become much more adept at addressing the shadow and welcoming the shadow than typical masculine culture does. You know, I actually am profoundly moved by so many different group of for women or for fembodied individuals. They often define themselves as shadow working groups. Right. They're very committed to this process. And I love how they've taken often the work of Carl Jung or or his children and have really like brought that into an integral practice. I see it as a tremendous step in the feminine culture at large. And I think, you know, men and the masculine have been a little slow to catching on. Right. But I think it's happening. Yeah.
Yeah. I recognize this as well, that there is I think we almost bond over our shadow as feminine bodies. Like there's a bonding that happens I call them shadow brags, in the vulnerability of, oh, I did this strange thing yesterday when I checked my phone 25 times to see if he texted back. Right. There is a connecting almost over our shadow. And I think that's very different in masculine culture versus feminine culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and I don't know how it goes because I'm never a part of these conversations of gal pals to their friends, but I do wonder if, you know, there is sort of a collective ability to be a little more vulnerable, to be a little more open. The feminine seems to have this wonderful networked and connected way of being that early stage masculine development simply just does not share.
Yeah.
It's a little more isolated often.
Yeah. Maybe for my almost last question, I know I saw you writing about this as well, and I think it's really an important conversation. So many people are talking about polarity and masculine, feminine. And I think some people can get very rigid about it, right? And I also, in my own teachings, always say, do not use my words to fuel your resentment. right? It's like, he's not conscious enough and she's not like appreciating me enough. And like this kind of stuff of like, it is a framework and it's not how we have to be. How do you see that? Maybe in the whole polarity sphere, how do you see rigidity there?
Boy, I really love how you just framed that. I wish I heard more people talk about that and talk like that within that particular framework. You know, words are really houses for the holy, but they themselves are not the holy. They themselves are not the sacred. They're just words. So I think we become very addicted to words because words are powerful. They really are. But words are also incredibly meaningless. we give them so much, you know, and I think that things like the masculine and feminine, those two words, they're really attempts to describe these archetypal and developmental journeys, these spiritual arcs that traditional cultures observed in the natural world around them and in their own physical bodies. You know, it's not maleness and femaleness, although I think I can look down at my physical body or the way I relate to the female and hold an analogy for these archetypes, but it's just an analogy. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think that really all the sacred things, all the true things, are those things that are wordless somehow. They're the things when I just find myself stammering. And haven't you experienced that too? I'm sure you have, that you experience something so deep, like, oh, the best sex ever. And it leaves you breathless. I mean, you're just wordless, you're speechless. Or that kiss or that tender moment or that sunrise or that tragic pain. And suddenly you have no words for it. You can't adequately describe it. And you spend the next 10 years just figuring out how you can speak of it. Right. I think that is real power. That is truth right there. And all the rest are just the labels we attach to it. So again, anything that we identify with, anything that we try to overly define, we end up having to defend, right? We end up we're addicted to it and it weighs us down. Why not, as Rilke said, why not let these things go to the wind? Yeah. And so I like using these words. Words are powerful, but I also abandon using these words routinely because words are so meaningless.
Yeah. And life happens in between them.
Oh, yes. Well, well added there. It's so true.
Okay. Very last question. And then I'll let you go. What do you love about the feminine? What do you love about the feminine, not just in a female body, but as an energetic on this world?
Oh, you know, I could tell you the fluff piece on this, but the truth is I really do love her chaos. I really do. You know, I whether in friendships or romantic liaisons, you know, I was just telling my partner recently, she sometimes will shy away from sharing her thoughts or feelings because she's really scared they're too chaotic or will be too much. I think a lot of people feel that. And, you know, I'll end up dragging it out of her, right? Like I'll end up like, you know, prying and probing until it all comes out, tumbling out. And then recently I laughed. I said, you know, I think you're just with the perfect person. Because the truth is, I just love the chaos of it all. I really love it. I love the tumult. And so the truth about the feminine is I think sometimes she can really be a whirlwind and a beautiful catastrophe. And I absolutely just love that energy, the softness to the jaggedness, the intensity to the delicacy of it all. And I think that is just so profoundly inspiring and it wakens my own heart. Yeah.
Rainier, beautiful. Thank you so, so much. If people want to hear more about you, Rainier, how can they find you? Where can they find you?
You can certainly go to my website, rainierwild.com, or just as often, come camp out with me at Instagram, Rainier Wild. I think almost daily I try and publish some short essay. I'm also coming out with a book upcoming, be released in July. I'm so excited about that. Called Meditations. It's an anthology of 30 different short meditations on selfing, the art of being a self in relationship to others.
Ooh, I can't wait for this book. That's so exciting.
You will get a copy.
Yay. Rainier, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate you so much and all your poetry. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, Sophie.
Thank you so much, my loves, for listening to another episode of the Deeper Podcast. If you enjoyed this, please pass along to even just one person who needs to hear this. And my love language is very much words of affirmation, so I love, love, love it when you share my work. If there was one sentence that popped out to you from today's episode, please do share it on your social media, tag me in it, and I will shower you with my gratitude. And always, if you want to stay connected, Instagram is the best place. That's where I'm the most active, sophie.josephina, or hop on my mailing list, sophiejosephina.com. And before I forget, all of these conversations, so every podcast episode is now also available on my YouTube channel, so you can always check it out there.